A history of comedy. It's seven old jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's seven old jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello and welcome to A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast from the University of Kent about the British stand-up comedy archive. I'm Ollie Double, this is my colleague Elspeth Miller, and we are very much the Mulder and Scully of comedy archiving.
I think we're going to do this for every episode, aren't we? But this is one that I know Mulder and Scully. But what do you mean by that, Ollie?
Well, what I mean is that, so we each have a way into the issue of comedy archiving. My way in is that I'm an academic who specialises in stand-up comedy and popular performance. So I've written about variety theatre, stand-up, sketch comedy, punk, all kinds of things like that. And this grows out of my former life as a stand-up comedian. So from the sort of late 80s through to 1999, I did professional work on the alternative comedy circuit. And then in 1997, I started working in universities. I came to Kent in 99, and that was when I stopped doing stand-up. But I've written a book back in 97. It came out called Stand Up on Being a Comedian. I wrote another in 2005, and then I did a sort of expanded edition that came out in 2014 called Getting the Joke, among other things that I've written. And so my interest is in sort of understanding the art and craft of stand-up comedy. And I think, you know, when I first started doing, I did a PhD years ago as well, I should say that, back in the 80s after I studied drama at the University of Exeter. And back in the 80s that was, and shortly after that I did a PhD about the sort of history of British stand-up comedy. And at that time, nobody had really done it. There wasn't really any academic interest in stand-up. There's quite a big field now, not just in the UK, but in America and other countries too. And I think that what makes my research particular is that I'm interested in how it's made. Because I think that people think that stand-up comedy appears by magic through the genius of the individual performer. But in fact, everybody has a process, even if they've never really thought about it much or shared it with anybody else. And I'm really interested in understanding that process, particularly because I still do some performance myself. And when I first started being an academic, it was weird because I was having to sort of interrogate myself about things that ways of working that had become habits without really much conscious thought. You know, I'd found a way of working, but I'd never really thought about what I did. And suddenly I found myself having to think about it. And to me, that was quite interesting.
Is that much more normal now amongst comedians in terms of that self-reflecting about how they create their stand-up?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, there's some very good podcasts now, like Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, which is a funny podcast, but he does talk about method and things. Mm. And in particular, Stuart Goldsmith's Comedians Comedian podcast, which is very much about sort of analysing how comedians work and sort of exploring methodology. And then also, yeah, Stuart Lee has written about his own work and sort of these kind of published scripts of his work, or transcripts, I suppose, which are heavily annotated, and he explains the thinking behind different bits of it. So, I think it has become more of a thing for comedians to think about what they do. I mean, actually, you can trace it back much further than that. Ken Dodd, who is pushing 90 now, when he started, before he started being a professional comedian, he was a travelling salesman, and he would keep a kind of ledger of how his jokes went. I mean, he would read lots of theory as well. So he would have a book where there'd be a column for sort of each joke. There'd be notes on venue, you know, time of day, weather. And then he would have a column where he would say how each joke went. And then he would kind of go back to that ledger when he was next in that same venue and use it to think about what material he was going to use. So what about you, Elspeth? What's your way into comedy archiving?
Well, I'm an archivist. So shall I explain what an archivist is?
Yeah.
That really helpful? So definitely. An archivist looks after archives. So
okay.
Archives.
So the clue's in the name.
Yeah, there. Absolutely. Archives, I take a broad definition, really, of archives. So anything that has been selected for long-term preservation. And that could be because it's got cultural value, historic value, business value, evidential value. And it could be held within a university or within a business or within a local kind of county archive. So you can have archives everywhere. And they can also be of any format, of course. So you've got your kind of official records, like your minutes and your accounts. And they could be more ephemera, so posters, playbills, flyers. They could be kind of audio and video recordings. Of course, they can be digital as well as kind of... So all of those things that I've just described exist in physical forms and digital forms as well. So digital audio recordings, digital flyers and posters. Because they're kind of... They've been selected as having long-term value and needing preservation, the work of an archivist is to kind of actively work to kind of secure those archives. So that could be through actively approaching people who might want to deposit in a museum or an archive or a library. Could even be just advising people who may not want to actively archive their work in an institution, but maybe want to create their own archive. And it means actively helping to preserve that material. So making sure it's in kind of proper enclosures, if it's on an obsolete format like cassettes or reel-to-reel, making sure that information, that recording is digitized and transferred to a more stable format. And it also means actively making sure that people are using the archives. That's kind of the whole point, really. They're being preserved for so that people can use them and interrogate them and get the information out of them. So a lot of my job is also to kind of answer inquiries from people, do kind of engagement and outreach work, such as this podcast, just to make sure that the material is being used. And also, obviously, cataloguing. I forgot about that. But that's a major part of my job.
So, because if you don't know what's there, you can't really use it.
Absolutely. Making sure that people can discover what we've got.
So what did you do before you came to Kent to do this?
So I've worked in a few different archives. My main professional experience before this was at the British Library in their Sound Archive, in the oral history section in particular.
Well, that's quite appropriate because stand-up is quite a verbal medium.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a really good experience. Gave me a lot of kind of grounding and knowledge in kind of how we handle audio, analogue and digital audio visual recordings.
So I mean, a lot of what you say is going to relate to this next question. So what is the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive?
So the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive exists at the University of Kent within our special collections and archives, which is in the library. So the Stand-Up Comedy Archive in particular was sort of, it came about when the university was offered two collections at quite similar times. So I think in 2012, John Pidgeon, who was a radio producer and journalist, offered the university his collection of audio interviews. And Warren Lakin, who was the partner of the late Lynn Smith, offered Linda's personal archive. So off the back of those two offers of kind of comedy, stand-up comedy related collections, the university, special collections and the School of Arts, so that this should be an area where we're actively collecting the area of stand-up comedy. Because obviously, of course, through your work, Ollie, the university has a really strong academic and teaching research interest in stand-up comedy. And a lot of the point of what the material that Special Collections collects is so that we can support academic research and teaching that goes on here. So off the back of that, it was quite a slow, that was in 2012, 2013. It wasn't until late 2014, 2015 that the university provided funds for a year to sort of establish a British stand-up comedy archive. And that funding allowed Special Collections to employ two members of staff, myself as the project archivist, and my colleague Erin, who was kind of digitization / assistant archivist. And throughout that year, it was kind of funding for a year, we actively approached comedians, comedy promoters, other people in the industry to actively work with them to archive material relating to stand-up comedy. So after that year and a bit of a kind of active collecting and all that kind of archive work that I was talking about, cataloguing, active preservation. We've got material from about 30 different depositors. So it's quite a good collection.
And those depositors are not just comedians, but also people who ran comedy clubs and I'm trying to think of other examples now. It's mainly those two, isn't it?
It's comedians mainly comedians, comedy clubs and comedy promoters.
Right.
And sometimes you've got people who do all those things. Something like Ivor Dembina is a comedian. He runs comedy clubs and he's in the past promoted acts as well. And then from academics as well, from yourself.
Right.
We've had quite a large collection. Andrew Sherlock up at Liverpool, we've had material. So, yeah, I think that kind of three main areas.
And I mean, when the idea was first suggested that we could try and start a national archive for stand-up, my worry was comedians can be quite secretive about how they work and quite protective and quite paranoid about people poaching their work, which is understandable given that their living is made through the fruits of their creative labours. You know, so you don't want people to nick your material, for example. So I asked a couple of people, you know, whether they would be interested in depositing stuff. And yeah, both of them said yes. And we got quite a lot of material. And then suddenly you're faced with the problem of, well, what do we do with this stuff? And it's like then going back to what you were saying earlier, digitising, cataloguing and all of that kind of thing. But here's the question. Stand-up comedy is live performance. And there is a problem with trying to archive that because, well, there's some research by somebody called Matthew Reason who's written very interestingly on the issue of trying to archive live performance. So he wrote an article in New Theatre Quarterly, which was published in February 2003, called Archive or Memory, The Detritus of Live Performance. And then later, he published a book called Documentation, Disappearance and the Representation of Live Performance, which came out in 2006. And in that book, he makes quite an interesting argument, which is quite sort of ambivalent about the whole project of archiving live performance. So to take a thing from the New Theatre Quarterly article, he says, the desire to document performance is a strong though contradictory thread running through the live arts. It is a desire motivated by an awareness of the inevitable disappearance of live performance. So the point is that live performance comes and goes. It happens in the moment and then it's gone. And he says, what he points out is, given the transience of live art, the live performance archive or museum is more problematic, as it, by definition, cannot contain actual performances. The thing itself is always absent. And that is undoubtedly true. You can't have a stand-up comedy performance, a live performance in an archive. I mean, you could have one, but it wouldn't be archived because it would disappear just as any other live performance does as it's happening. You know, it comes and goes moment by moment. You know, he points out that one of the things that happens as a result of this practically is that anything that is remotely associated with the performance can belong in an archive. And that's true, isn't it? Because because the kind of things we've got in the stand-up comedy archive are extraordinarily varied.
Yeah. I mean, you've got, I'm sure when people think about stand-up comedy archive, things come to mind. So we have set lists, we have audio and video recordings, we have posters and flyers, and other promotional material. And then because we've collected from kind of comedy club promoters and comedy club owners, we've also got that kind of the business side of comedy. So we've got invoices, we've got account books, we've got diaries, booking in performers. We've got some of the archives that we've got from promoters are actually some of the richest in the kind of the breadth that they offer, because comedians send material to the promoters so that they can get a gig. So we might have material from a particular club, but we've got photos from loads of different performers within that archive. And then of course we've got things like props. We've got kind of audience contributions sometimes as well.
Costume items.
We have costume items, yeah. I'm trying to think. It's quite comprehensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really comprehensive. It's incredibly varied and comprehensive. Yeah. I mean, we've got, you know, props, weird things like wallpaper, you know, all kinds of crazy things. And for me, personally, the thing that really excites me is the unpublished recordings, because that's just, I mean, I never thought when we started the project that we would have some of the things that we have got. And of course, these are all things we're going to explore as the podcast develops.
Well, we have unpublished, and we also have rehearsal recordings as well, which is also can be quite interesting, I think.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, rehearsal recordings is an extraordinary idea, because I mean, a lot of comedians don't rehearse, actually. I mean, they rehearse in front of a live audience. Sure. So the idea that we have, but then we have that as well. We have recordings of sort of tryout gigs and Edinburgh previews and things as well. But the thing that Reason says in his, I should just say that those quotes from earlier were between his article and his book. They were from both sources. But in his book, he says this, going back to that point about disappearance, he says the ephemerality of live performance means that it must be consciously documented if it is not to disappear, with the primary preoccupation not the creation of new art, but ensuring the documentation of existing art. I mean, what do you think about that argument? I mean, the idea is, well, it's a little bit pointless because all you're doing is preserving the past. You're not doing anything positive for the future.
So I think what we're doing is both of those things. We are trying to kind of preserve the past. But I think within the context that we are in, a kind of an academic research teaching environment, we're definitely trying to kind of inspire new performances, particularly from your students have come in and used the material. Comedians have come in and looked at the material. So I think with our material, we're definitely trying to inspire those new performances.
Yeah, we have various different modules and courses at the University of Kent, which allow students to explore stand-up comedy, both sort of theoretically and practically. And as the archive has grown, we've been finding ways of using it more and more to show students things about the past history of stand-up comedy, but also looking at things like set lists and script notes to show them that there's not just one fixed method, that you have to find the method that fits you. And I think that's really important, because some of those students will go on probably to have their own career in comedy. Certainly we've got some people who've come through the university who've gone on to work professionally in comedy, either as individual comics or, you know, in groups or what have you. And I think hopefully the ones that come out from now on, you know, now they can work with material in the archive. I mean, it is very much about the creation of future comedy. Reason isn't the only person, is he, to write about archiving performance?
I was just sent an article by Enrique Oque, who's the archivist at the Rambert Dance Company. And it's not yet been published, actually, in print. I think it's published in autumn in print. But it's a really interesting article. She's talking about archiving at the Rambert Company. So she's talking about what to collect, that kind of collaboration. We haven't talked really about the collaboration between kind of the performer and audience, because I think what Reason was saying is that you can't archive that live performance, because even if, you know, we've got audio and video recordings of live performance, the performance itself is not just the performer, it's the audience and their interaction with it. So she's talked a lot about that. But there's a really lovely part where she's talking about kind of reuse of the archive, where she describes it as compost. So I'll just read that out. She says, "The keeping of an archive seems to be able to make the past works move from being untouchable to becoming compost for new investigations and ideas and new interactions with audiences, by virtue of making them reaccessible and by making clear the reuse and representation possibilities after the death of the first generation who created and performed them." Yeah. I love that idea of compost.
Yeah, well, actually,
archive is compost for new ideas.
Yeah, compost, I think, might be a theme of this episode, because thinking about it, his point about disappearance is a good one. Like, I would hate for, you know, a comedian, say, to die and all of their stuff ends up in a skip, and that valuable material is just then gone. Nobody has access to it. And the thing about that is, it goes back to what you were saying about archiving being about what's worth preserving. And my fear is that what, you know, something will end up in landfill being kind of compost / pollution, where it could be preserved and actually used as, you know, creative compost for a new generation of performers.
Well, that's one of the things we were trying to do through the kind of the year funded project, is even if people didn't want to kind of deposit material with us, that they knew that other people thought it's important. Because that was one of the reactions that we had when we approached people, was like they were surprised that we'd be interested in them at all, or interested in an old set list, when actually that's like that's the main thing you're interested in. Well, one of the main things you're interested in, isn't it?
It's one of the main things I'm interested in. I mean, of course, one of the interesting things about set lists and comedian script notes is they're not transparent in the way that a play text is. I mean, we'll deal with this in a future episode. But the point is, it's like there was a story in the 90s, a big news story about Bob Monkhouse, the late Bob Monkhouse, and his joke books were lost. And people, there were lots of other people joking about it, like it was a funny thing. He got them back, thankfully. But these were huge volumes that had sort of been throughout his career. And but the point is, you know, those books, the content of those books would probably have no value to anybody but him, because when you write for yourself, and you write, it's to help your future self remember the ideas that you had so that you can then develop or perform it. And quite often they're kind of cryptic. So you could see a set list and you could compare it. We've got this in the archive. You can look at a set list and then you can hear an associated recording of that material. And, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find the connections at times, but that's not the point. The point is that that set list was written for that comedian. So what this means is that we need to actively interpret the material. It's not just about collecting it and just popping it in a acid-free box or whatever. It's about, well, I don't know, I've probably got that wrong.
No, you're good, good.
Is that
good
right?
Good with the acid-free box, yeah.
Okay, archivally correct.
Yeah.
Good. But the point is that it's also about sort of saying, well, what does it mean? And that's what this podcast is about. So the idea of this podcast is that in every episode, we will have an item from the archive and we will actively interpret it in order to sort of try and bring out what its significance is for, I suppose, both the history of stand-up comedy and also what it reveals of the craft and the art of stand-up comedy too. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Cool. So, that said, this is the first episode. This has been quite a long preamble, although necessary, I think, to set up the podcast. But we have, of course, this being History of Comedy and Several Objects, an object with us today. So, Elspeth, can you tell us what it is?
Okay, our first object is from J.C. Long's collection. So J.C. gave material to us about this time last year, although she was one of the people you approached years ago.
J.C. was one of the first people I asked, and she instantly said yes, but it's very difficult to actually make an arrangement with a comedian to set up a deposit because it's so low in their priorities for good reasons. Yeah. I'm not saying that in a bad way. They're such busy people and they make their living through other activities than giving stuff to a university. Yeah. And then there's also another thing, I think, which is, well, what do I want to let go? What has too much emotional attachment or whatever? So yeah, she said yes straight away, but it took a while to kind of come through. Sure. So what is the object?
Okay, so the object is an orange. Okay. A real nice orange. So, although actually that is in dispute amongst myself and colleagues.
Right.
So whether this is an orange, it's labelled as an orange, but it looks quite small to be an orange. Anyway,
so what,
it's an orange. It's a citrus fruit of some.
So wait, you think it could be a tangerine or a satsuma?
I think it could be a tangerine, but we'll never know.
Well, let's describe it
this
for the listener.
Okay, so it is a citrus fruit, orange in colour, or it was orange at one point.
Yeah, what colour is it now?
It's kind of like, it's a very, very dark orange brown.
With elements of black.
Yeah. It's
the colour an orange goes if you leave it for a while.
Leave it for 9 years, yeah.
For 9 years?
Well, this is from 2008, apparently.
How do you know that?
Well, title of object is 2008 orange.
So it's in a clear plastic box.
Yes. When I was looking at this morning, somebody went to the trouble of getting a Cucinaware Basics box for it. Anyway.
So it's a clear plastic box, and on the top there's a piece of paper that looks like it's perhaps cut from a post-it note.
Yeah.
And it says,
title of object is 2008 orange. Description: J.C. Long threw this orange into the audience at the 2008 Trying Is Good show, Melbourne. My friend Sam caught it and gave it to me. Donated by Karen. Date of show attended 13th of the 1st, 2009.
Wow. So what is it then?
Okay, so this object is part of, well, it's from Jace's show, which was All the Planets Wonders, which she took to Edinburgh in 2008, Edinburgh Festival Fringe in 2008. took it on tour in 2009. And as part of the Edinburgh run in 2008, she sent out a call to audience members, to those coming to the show, in that she wanted objects. And I've got also the kind of the call out. Shall I read out?
Oh yeah, go for it.
This is actually on Jose's website. So if you have a look for the All the Planets Wonders section, you'll find the call. Anyway, it says, please contribute to the J. Long Edinburgh Anthropology Collection. Send me your objects, mundane, mysterious, or stolen, pieces of Edinburgh ephemera Edinburgh, she says, question mark, and then with a little asterisk, she says, I really have to stop doing this. Each piece should be labelled with your own handwritten tag, thus, and then she gives an example. Please drop them or send them into the Pleasance, addressed to Josie Long, Head of Museum Collection, care of Pleasance Theatres and Courtyard.
So what's delightful about that is it's an archiving, or albeit a comedy archiving exercise.
Yep.
So that's why it was kind of a perfect item for the first episode. But it also has connections with two shows.
Yeah.
So it's from All Planets Wonders, but it was originally given or thrown to an audience member in Melbourne for trying his good. What do you think it reveals about the nature of stand-up?
Well, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, in that sort of that live performance, and you can't capture a live performance. And what's important about live performance is that it's that kind of, it's a shared experience between your performer, your comedian, and or whatever genre you're performing in, and the audience. And that's why every performance is never going to be the same again. And that's what I really like about The Orange, is that it's kind of an audience contribution back to a new show.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, as you say, you know, one of the things that Reason and others talk about in terms of the impossibility of trying to archive live performances, you can never put into an archive that sort of living experience of being there, sitting in your seat, perhaps with a drink in front of you, laughing and listening. That's the thing you can't get. But what you can do is collect objects that cast a bit of light on that. And of course, you know, for many conventional stand-up comedy shows, people just walk away with the memory of that experience. But that person walked away with an orange. What's incredible actually is that what's happened to it is it's a bit like one of those Christmas decorations where you put cloves in and put talcum powder in. It's you know, a bog body perhaps, where instead of just rotting and going to mould, it's gone to kind of leather, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's doing really well considering it's 9 years old. Eight and a half years old. And it doesn't, there's no kind of external signs of mould.
None at all. Okay, well, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But then it's sort of interesting for that reason, just in terms of that thing of the comedian giving a physical gift to audience members. I think Josie's not the only comedian who would do something like that, I think. But I think it is very typical of her style. It's a very good-hearted kind of earnest, positive approach to comedy. Whereas what's interesting about that, I mean, when I first saw Josie, which was, I think, Trying is Good, I think was the first show that I saw her do, and I was blown away instantly. It was like discovering a new band and going, right, I'm going to buy every single album they put out. Because one of the things that really got me about it was the lack of cynicism, because I like cynical comedy, but cynicism is like the letters that go through rock, you know, in stand-up. It's like, the bottom line of comedy is skepticism and cynicism, and, you know, and it's often pessimistic, and it can be quite nasty as well. You know, comedy often has a target, there's a butt of a joke. And what's great about Josie is it's so positive and lovely and sort of warm, and that's, you know, you'd think, well, being a good person is not a funny quality. You know, you have to be flawed to be, you know, to be funny. But she comes out and she's so delightful and sort of you want to be a friend kind of thing. And she makes you feel warm and like, oh, this is, the world's a good place. We can make the world a better place. There's an orange, you know. But then the other side of her is the sort of nerdiness, the collector, the kind of geek. And I think that its return to her is also interesting.
Lovely, isn't it?
It is lovely, yeah. Maybe it's been preserved by love.
I know. Well, we collected it from Josie's office. That's where her archive was kind of being, Well, it's the Arts Emergency Office.
Yeah. Arts Emergency being her excellent charity, yeah. Or not just hers, but I mean, you know, that she's sort of pioneered this charity, helping to give opportunities to young people by giving them mentors and so on.
Yes, that's where we collected her archive from. So it must, I don't know where it was before that, but it's in fairly good condition. I mean, I don't think it poses a great kind of preservation risk to other material. All right, although I do have archivist guilt on the orange.
All right, let's talk about your archivist guilt. So the archivist guilt is what?
It was an orange in the archive. I mean, so we're very controlled about how we provide access to lots of our physical material, in that where copyright allows, we are able to put material online, but otherwise you have to come in to the reading room, which is in the library. And that's a kind of an environment where you can't take in anything that's going to damage material.
So you have to use pencils.
No food, yep, no drink, no pens, only pencils, no sweets and chewing gum. So we don't allow food in the archive.
But that's food.
But we do, or have once food was. In, yeah, once was, I think.
Here's the question. So food stuff in the archive, right? I mean, just like you can't preserve live performance, well, normally you can't preserve an orange for 9 years.
No.
So is that the only example you can think of food stuff being in the archive or in an archive?
Well, we have chocolate in the British Cartoon Archive in the Carl Giles collection. So he was a cartoonist.
Giles, the famous Giles.
Yes. Yeah. So we have kind of his studio, basically. So when he died, it wasn't immediately after he died, but British Cartoon Archive has the contents of his studio, which included things like artwork and pens and pencils and also chocolate. So we have some After Eights, I think, and Kit Kat. And then...
Because they're going to be like well over 10 years old now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, yeah. I don't know how old they are. But then, yeah, I mean, you do get food.
Are there other archives that have
there
food?
There are. Like, there's... So I have tried to do a bit of research into this as part of my archivist guilt. And so, like, anthropological museums, like the Horniman Museum, for example, has objects made from food stuff. And then my favourite was the Abingdon Bun Museum.
Wait, let's just celebrate.
And sorry,
that.
It's not the Abingdon Bun Museum. Sorry, it's the Abingdon Museum.
Right.
Has buns from the Abingdon Bun Throwing Festival, I think it is.
Right, the Abingdon Bun Throwing Festival.
Yes.
Superb. So, I mean, I'm not a massively patriotic person by nature, but those kind of things, those kind of folk rituals involving food stuff.
Yeah, well, I think they go up to this kind of the city county hall roof or something and throw buns down. Like the councillors go up and then throw buns down.
Wow.
The people.
Wow.
Yeah. So they have food stuffs as well.
That'd be fun to risk
ideally,
assess as an event.
Yeah.
I mean, no pointed raisins or whatever. No.
Yeah, I mean, from that height, it'd be quite speed, wouldn't it?
If it caught you in the eye, you'd know about it.
I don't think there's been any casualties from
right.
what I read.
Good.
I mean, we keep this, it's in its own little plastic kind of box, and then it's in its own other box, kind of archive box. So it's separate to its fellow objects from all the planet's wonders. Ideally, food stuff you put in a fridge. I mean, we keep archive material within climate controlled conditions, so temperature controlled and humidity controlled, and then monitored.
Because anything can decay. I mean, paper decays over
absolutely,
time.
Yeah.
So you control the environment to preserve.
Yeah, and again, you don't have food in your store, like you wouldn't go and eat in your store because of attracting pests.
Even a pest wouldn't want to eat that.
Well,
now.
No, I think we are safe. I don't think this can do any damage, but
it's. I mean, I think what's happened there is, I mean, going back to the thing about Christmas decorations, I think what's happened is it's like when you put that in the airing cupboard.
Yes.
Go back to the opposite of the fridge in a way. What happens is it desiccates, and I think once that's what it looks like has happened. It looks like there's no fluid left in it, and that's why it hasn't moulded. You know.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Because it's dried and become literally like leather. You know, you cure leather.
I think it's hollow on the inside.
So you mentioned that it wasn't the only thing that Josie donated from that project, from the archiving project.
Yeah, so other people, not only Karen, who sent the orange, but other people did send...
I hope Karen listens to this episode.
do a reunion, Jack reunion. Other people sent material to Josie for her show. Although what's interesting about this was donated in January, mm-hmm. so it was past the Edinburgh show. So I don't know if she carried on with the call.
Yes, I think how Josie works, how she tends to work, is that she'll do an Edinburgh show and then tour it round small venues. Sure, yeah. So I haven't seen her, I don't think, in Edinburgh, but I've seen most of her shows. Yeah. So
the call for objects was a constant call through the tour then, maybe. But we've got some other objects. So some of them are Edinburgh related. So we've got somebody sent in a pen. So it's a Cafe Picante. Pen from Edinburgh, and the
and that rattling is the sort of
preserving
plastic envelope that it sits in.
So the label for this pen is one Cafe Picante chip shop pen. Apparently they are world record holders, but they don't say what for. .. So this was given, I think, in the Edinburgh, like an August Edinburgh show, and then somebody also gave Josie a badge. Title of this object is Monkey Badge. The description.
Who wouldn't like a monkey badge?
An I Monkeyed Around at Edinburgh Zoo badge purchased on a day of fun at Edinburgh Zoo on the 22nd of August 2008. There were lots of good monkeys. The polar bear seemed to be suffering from depression, though.
Oh, no.
Date of show attended 21st of the 8th, 08. Oh, so they attended the show, then went and got the badge, and then sent it in afterwards. This was donated by Anna Marie McMahon.
Well, in a way, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because what it suggests is that the relationship between the comedian and the audience doesn't finish when they leave the venue. And that's true anyway now because of things like social media and, I suppose, in the past, fan mail. But, that's quite interesting because when does the performance finish? Mm-hmm. If somebody's sending something in that's connected with the performance as part of the performance project, does that mean the performance is still taking place when that occurs? Question.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Do you want to have a look at that one?
Oh, go on then.
It's the little thing there.
Oh, yeah, look at that. So there's a little metal thing, and it says, the note that accompanies it is on a Josie Long ticket for All the Planet's Wonders from the Bloomsbury Theatre, and that would have been September 2008, so just after Edinburgh. Witchy earring bought from the Argento store in Victoria, where you can also buy devils for £1. That's brilliant. And what's that you're holding?
This is a bear, cuddly bear. Do you want to have a look at that one?
Oh, go on then. So this is a cuddly bear, which has an awful lot of information on. Stuffed bear with hooded fleece. A teddy bear with a hooded fleece. I wonder if it'd be banned from corner shops. Donated by Luke in August 08. Upon arriving at our new flat for the first time, my housemates discovered this bear which had been left by the previous occupants, an act which contains at least a trifle of mystery, since by all accounts they were shy brackets French lot that cowered from our gaze when we happened to visit for a flat viewing. You see, what I think is great about this, and actually... I'm pushing the boat out here, but I think this speaks to comedy's ability to engage an audience at quite a deep level and therefore change the world. Now, you might say that's nonsense, somebody just said to a bear, right? But a bear in a fleece, right? But also the thing is that the reason I say that is because I think go back to Josie's positivity. So one of her things is a delight in small things. Little everyday things that you see around the place that just make you happy. So, for example, I was up in Blackpool last week and I saw a Pizza Hut where the neon sign had broken and it just said PIZZ, which makes the pizza so really unappetizing. I was delighted, right? And I think that these things speak of pleasure in small things, you know, a devil earring that you can buy for £1, you know. Somebody who's amused by the idea of a chip shop that's got a world record, but for something that it remains unclear. You know, little trifling mysteries and delicious, obscure weirdness hidden around everyday life. And by making it not just her telling the audience about her examples, but encouraging them to tell her about theirs, it creates an exchange, a really interesting exchange of ideas that perhaps changes in a small, tiny way the way those people interact with the world more generally. So perhaps they look around for those kind of things more. And interestingly, you know, since that time, Josie's become known for political comedy, and she's got some, she's had some pretty angry and very interesting shows railing against things that have happened under the coalition government and you know, things the Tories have done and so on. And a lot of people sort of said, well, you know, that's a change. But I never thought it was. I always thought her act was political, because it was by being against cynicism. It was about the idea that we have kind of control over our own lives. And that's quite an important political idea, I think. Another thing I wanted to say, going back to that thing about, you know, the exchange between performer and audience. So she gives things out and then they give things back. I remember going to one of her shows, probably Trying Is Good, where she asked people to write down their favourite small things.
Yep, we've got some examples of those as well.
We have. Yeah. And it was used, she had them scanned and they're included as a PDF on the DVD that was produced. And I was delighted when the DVD came out, because mine was there.
Oh, right? What was it?
It was, if you take a peanut apart, it looks like there's a tiny little rabbit in there. The bit that holds the two halves of the peanut together looks like a rabbit shape, because it's got two little ears on it. So when we got when I knew we had those things, the actual physical objects, the sort of slips have been stuck onto a thing for scanning, I went through and went, oh, there's my one. So it's kind of come back.
Oh, so we can, what, did it have your name on it?
I can't remember. It might have done, actually. Yeah, I think so. I don't know, it's this delightful thing of sending things out into the world and then they kind of come back, you know, a bit like the orange, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we should talk about in, well, I suppose actually there is one thing here. This printout that we've got of the call for contributions, what I like about it is it's not typeset or anything, it's just handwritten. You know, this is, I think, part of Josie's ethos, really, of things being homemade. It doesn't have to look perfect. You can just do something hand-drawn, and actually that has its own appeal. I think that's a theme that we'll explore in future episodes. But is there anything else apart from that?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, that's fine, because this podcast isn't just about us telling you things. It's also about you getting involved yourself.
Get involved!
And there are various ways that you can get involved. First of all, you can go to our catalogue, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it. You can nominate it via email. Our email is
standup, or one word, no hyphen, at kent.ac.uk.
Or you can contact us via social media. And you can nominate that item, and we will talk about it in a future episode. That's the vanilla version of getting involved.
The chocolate chip version of getting involved is to come and visit us. Come to the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive in special collections at the Templeman Library. Look at material for yourself, either for fun or research or, there's no teaching.
Well, you don't have to be an academic.
No, you don't have to. Just for fun. That's the fun.
Good.
And you could even record a short piece about one of the objects you've looked at. Send us the audio and we'll feature it in a future episode.
And the final and silliest version of getting involved is do your own cover version of our theme tune, send it to us, and if we like it, we'll use it in a future episode.
I've had that theme tune in my head all weekend.
Sorry about that.
No, it's great. I've loved it.
Okay, cool.
We should say also that we're on Twitter.
Yeah, we are on Twitter.
Our Twitter handle is histcompod.
There we go. So that's all for the first episode of A History of Comedy in Several Objects.
A History of Comedy in Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hoss.